Welcome to the Building Better Futures for Health series. I'm your host, Richard Sokolov. I'm the co-founder and executive director of ODE Group. In this series, we'll be speaking to former contestants, winners, and judges of the Building Better Futures for Health competition. Today, I have a special guest, Dr. Alan Taylor. Alan has a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology, is a former director of an investment bank, is a co-founder of a novel company dealing with logistics, and is also executive chairman of recently listed Clarity Pharmaceuticals, who are developing novel radiopharmaceutical theranostics. He is also, most importantly, founding judge of Building Better Futures for Health. Welcome, Alan.
Thanks, Richard. Great to be here.
Oh, it's awesome to have you here, mate. Good to see you after a while in the pandemic and the shutdowns and lockdowns.
I know.
It's been, you know,
we kick on, don't we?
So yeah. We keep battling on. You've been very busy. For those listeners and viewers, Clarity Pharmaceuticals, you're the executive chairman of that company, have recently IPO'd on the ASX, raised $92 million in the IPO. I think that's a record for a biotechnology company in Australia. That's fantastic. I was so proud of that moment for you. You started with Clarity. I think you keep on telling the story about having a couple of patents and working with some of the founders and the researchers, and now you've taken it to this level. How about we just kick off with talking about that journey with you and Clarity, and let's go from there, explore that.
Sure, that'd be great, yeah. So if I start with Clarity, you know, because I'm fascinated with the science, obviously, and so the beginning of Clarity started many decades ago with a great scientist out at ANU, a guy named Professor Alan Sargeson, who just wanted to come up with this novel idea of trying to hold copper. And that, which doesn't sound that interesting at all, but the two isotopes of copper, copper-64, is a fantastic PET imaging agent, which we use a lot now in cancer, for instance. And then it's really coupled with this perfect pairing of copper-67. Mm. And copper-67 is a therapeutic radioisotope. Mm. So once we know we can hit a tumor, once it binds to that tumor, then we can use copper-67 to obviously terminate that tumor as the goal with few side effects. And so what we're doing is trying to advance cancer therapies for children and adults. So we're doing neuroblastoma in kids, we're doing prostate cancer, breast cancer, and we're looking at other cancers now. But that initial work really drove where we are today. So that got into the hands of a gentleman called Professor Paul Donnelly, who was able to make these cages are much more effective. They were bifunctional, so we could do two things with them.
We're talking about cages that hold the copper. Yep.
It's that simple. It's just a cage. We call it a chelator, but it's a cage that holds it, right? And then what we can do is bind these small molecules or antibodies or peptides to that to target the cancer. Mm-hmm. That's really who we are. That's really what we do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I you mentioned when I first joined Clarity, and that's my passion, obviously. We know each other through the translation of science.
I have to just say that you're probably one of the most passionate people about entrepreneurship that I know. We always have a beer talk about this passion for entrepreneurship and the journey. So I just wanted everyone to understand
and
that.
And the question is whether it's purely entrepreneurship or where I like to fit in the market, you know, which is more the translation of science.
Yeah.
But I was in banking for a long time, and then I shifted out of that purely to do what we're doing. Mm. And then Clarity came along straight away. Mm-hmm. My goal at the time, this is April 2013, was to have a year off. I was monumentally unsuccessful at that. But Clarity crossed my desk within an hour of me sending out an email to my contacts. So I said no, you know, there was a few opportunities then, but I wanted to catch up with the kids.
Yeah.
Because investment banking is really arduous as a job. So but that was great. I had some time off. I got my head around Clarity. It was very early stage, a couple of provisional patents even at that time, and no money. It was out of money. It was about to bust, like typical a lot in the Australian.
What piqued your interest about Clarity specifically? What was it?
So the reason why I said no is because it was purely on the diagnostic side at the time. Mm. I just don't want to tell people they got cancer, right? Yeah. Even though that has some benefit maybe for other therapies, but I wanted to be on the therapeutic side. Mm. My background was always on the therapeutic side in the investment banking world, and I wanted to focus on treating or curing people of disease. Mm. So that led to a discussion internally with them and to say, listen, I want to move here. I don't want to be here. This is too hard to do this. Mm. And they were told, you know, it was one gentleman in particular. He was told, well, we can't do therapeutics in Australia because we don't have the capital markets and we don't have that sort of thing. You know, the typical, we can't raise money here, right? And I said, well, my background is that, right? Yeah. And the predominance of the deals we worked on when I was in investment banking were in the US. So I shifted out of that to focus on Aussie translation. You know, I'm not typically, you know, I'm not a flag-waving Aussie all the time, you know, but when it comes to science, I think we do terrific science here, but we're missing that jump, right? Yeah. And they were stuck at that time. So then I could obviously use my skills and experience. My background's in biochemistry and molecular biology, so I had a detailed understanding of the mechanisms of how it worked. And then so I jumped on board. They were looking to raise a couple of hundred thousand that time. They raised 50,000. It was dead in the water. You've seen this before. So I said, let's change the deal. Let's raise $1 million. We closed that out within a couple of months. Put my own money in there, you know, as a believer.
As you do,
Yeah, because you have to be obviously a believer.
I think people miss that bit, right? That I think, you know, having some interest in it, whether it's skin in the game financially or something else, there's a passion for it, is really part of actually going through all this uncertainty, jumping through these hurdles. Without that, it's sometimes hard to push it through to the outcome that you seek.
I think impossible.
Yeah.
I think impossible. Yeah. You know, someone described it the other day, you actually become somewhat of a cult leader, right? Because you're bringing everyone along for this story this detail. Now, we work in a highly sophisticated area, right? So we're publishing research and those sorts of things. Mm. So the people you're bringing along are incredibly bright.
Yep.
Lots of them have PhDs. They all know, you know, they all can sniff, you know, rubbish when they see it, right? So so you're bringing along a really smart group of people. Now our board, we move 8 years on.
Yep.
Half of our board are from a former company, Algeta, that was bought by Bayer for $2.9 billion US dollars.
Yep.
So we got three of our board from there, including our CEO now, who shifted into that role a couple of years ago. And we've been able to, you know, now raise, we're talking about the $92 million. And that's a line in the sand to go public. It's quite interesting. And because I'd been previously in the banking side, we'd previously done the largest prior to that, $85 million Aussie dollars. So it was good to
beat that. On the other side of the fence.
Yeah, this is a competition coming up. But it was good doing that and good putting ourselves in a strong position. But it comes around fundamentally building from the bottom up.
Yeah.
Strong patents, great science, great clinical development, great results, great board, great management team, which then puts that all in place. So now we've raised probably about $140 to $150 million. We've got about $100 million in the bank still.
And it's interesting because you mentioned all that from the ground up, but it's also from the inside out, right? That vision you talked about being almost like a cult leader. It's how important it is for people to buy into where you're going and pull it all together. I think one of the things that we do in all our work is we always ask why. Why are you doing this? What's the purpose behind what you're doing? Because without knowing that, it's hard to add value along the journey. And all these people that come on your journey that you just described, I think they have to buy into that vision, right? They have to know that they want to believe in where they're going or have skin in the game to get there. I think that's so, so important. And that's sort of underpinning the science, underpinning the commercial aspects of the whatever we're trying to commercialize.
That's right. Yeah. And it comes from just a thorough view. So this, you know, when people say, why do you do it? I'll tell you why. This week we're dosing a child, treating neuroblastoma. That's why we do it.
Yeah.
It's really easy to be empathetic to that situation.
Yeah.
Whether it's prostate cancer in an old, that man is a father, a grandfather, a husband or whatever, uncle.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to be empathetic. So so that every day. Yes, there's a corporate side, a capital side, a raising side and all that, but that's there in the markets.
Yep.
When you're fundamentally looking at the science and you're trying to change people's lives,
100%.
It's easy to get up every day.
Well, it resonates very heavily with me because every time I'm in a project or having a project team meeting, I'm going, would you want to use that on your child or your daughter or your wife or your dad? You know, how would they react to it? And it's like, it's always, you have to bring that. And that always gives me sort of like, gets me a bit emotional because that's really why I never started out in medtech. I sort of went into it. But once I got into it, it sort of has really been driving me for all these past 18 years, especially at IDE, is because you feel that connection because you sort of relate it to, you know, I remember when my dad was in hospital and it was getting injected by a device that I'd worked on, you know, and I could see the benefits to him, you know. It was a very emotional time for me because it was in a lot of pain. But these things, I think people don't realize how powerful they are to motivate people like you to do what you've just done. Obviously, the journey is not complete with clarity. It's a journey. And I think that's something that I think, you know, you talk about all the regulation, you talk about all the science, you talk about all the technology, but in the end, it boils down to this human aspect and this human drive to make something better, to build a better future, right? Which is essentially why we're here and why this competition, just to bring that into it, is here, is to help people realize some of these things. So I just segue there a little bit.
Yeah. Just to cap off on that part, it's not just me. You know, I'm sort of a little bit of the ringleader or the cult leader, if you like. But you're bringing along the whole team of incredible people. We're 15 to 20 now internally, but we're using CROs around the world. So when you're building all that in, suddenly there's a lot of people who are being influenced or being part of that story, and seeing from the ground up, you know, this is the science we do here. Yep. This is the clinical we do here. These are the outcomes we do here at all the different levels. And everyone is part of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's so important to be able to string all that together, Alan. So I think you've done phenomenally well. I want to now move and talk about your origin story, because you start off in science. You made your way into where you are now. You went to investment banking. You know, some people call it the dark side. You know, no offense to any investment bankers out there. But can you just tell us what was behind these choices that you made along your career path? Because it's quite eclectic. We said that at the beginning before we started taping this, but it is very eclectic. And you're also my person to look up to because you've done so much of this from different sides of the table. So can you tell us a little bit about that journey and why these changes?
Yeah. Why don't I start with the first? Because that's probably what's driven me most, the science side, right? And science these days is a little bit of a political football.
Yeah,
and there's an anti-science movement, which I don't understand, you know, from that perspective, because entrenched in me from a very young age is the concept of observing and measuring the world around us so we can make useful predictions, right? So, you know, my parents, I grew up, you know, we immigrants, moved into Redfern area, and I remember my earliest days were in Housing Commission in Waterloo, but my parents we lived on the 14th floor, they bought me a telescope. So I had the telescope up there, I'm looking at the moon, you know, and you see the moon up there, and then you see Mars, you know. How did I know it was Mars? Because it's red, right? So you're observing the world in real time, exactly what's going on. And that's sort of, you know, with chemistry sets and those sorts of things. And so that was great as a kid. But I want to touch on probably the greatest sort of impact on my life were probably those development years. And I think, you know, having Radio Hub as part of this and Cooper, who knows my background, so I can't make it up, right?
Well, for those who don't know, Alan and I and the other co-founder of ID, George, and Cooper from Radio Hub all went to Waverley College together.
All went to Waverley.
But we didn't know about that when we first met you, right, Alan?
That's right. So we all went to the same school. But with sort of Cooper and Craig Markham, we were on the dark side at Waverley because we were all leagueies. Yeah. Right? So
no union boys.
Yeah, yeah. And so I played sort of Paddo Colts and played for the Roosters all the way through juniors and then some seniors. And it was great, right? But there's some people who are really special to that development, right? So at the Paddington Colts, there was a guy named Dickie Wells, who was our coach from about 14s to about 17s or something. I moved out. Yep. But Dick was one of these guys. He was meticulous, right? He would write everything down about every game. He was a student of the game all the time. When I say that, you know, there's a thing in, for instance, the martial arts, the white belt mentality. Mm. What that is you just hunger for knowledge, right? And then you want to implement that knowledge all the time.
Absolutely.
Dick was one of those guys. He was so enthusiastic and driven and wanted his team to win and was so well-drilled that we would end up being so good that we never lost the game in the seasons. It was such a strong side, right? Mm. And so, but you learn from that as a kid, right? You know, Dick passed on this year, which was quite sad, but went to his funeral and they brought out all the books that he wrote up on every game.
Really?
There's all of us and how we played and wrote all the notes of every game.
That's crazy.
He was running it like we were the Australian team, right? Wow. But we were playing park football for the Paddo Colts, right?
So
and under 14s.
About, yeah.
And it doesn't matter. I think that's really important. It doesn't matter where you are or what you're doing. Mm. What you should be doing is loving it and doing it 1,000%, because then you get the thrill out of it, right? It's exciting and that. So learning those skills are incredibly important. So what is being thorough and enthusiastic and all
curious
these different things, how does that benefit your life?
Yep.
Well, in every aspect, right?
Yeah.
Every aspect. So I end up leaving for a particular – we were winning, seriously, every game by 50 points, right? So – and everyone knows life isn't like that, right? So I actually left to lose, you know? It sounds bizarre, right?
But, to some it would, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you have to learn to – I think you learn much more from losing than winning.
Yeah.
So I did that and just to, you know, craft my game a little bit differently and get different strategies because we were so – well-polished and well-prepared. And I learned all those skills already, which was great. Go and see what it's like when it's not there.
Not there.
Right? Yeah. When you're in chaos. Yeah. And and see if you can bring some, you know, order to chaos, which is such important. So then I had that, you know, great opportunity at the Roosters for a while. And go the Roosters, by the way. better like next year, hopefully less injuries. It was a shocker this year for injuries. But and you look at the professionalism in that club now, you know, it's phenomenal. But then I shifted out. You know, I'm only a little guy, but really the focus of my training years was understanding how my body worked, training all the time and trying to put on size. You know, I played at 77 kilo. I'm not much more now, you know. So I was only light, but I learned all that sort of exercise and learning how the body worked. That just naturally evolved into moving into science.
Physiology. I don't have to call it naturally, but that's
physiology, fantastic. You know, and that just for me, it was all about things. So I went to Sydney Uni. I did an applied science degree. I majored in part of that in exercise science, which was great. Mm. So I could translate that. But then that moved into my honours was, you know, suddenly in rats. But it was all on muscle metabolism.
Wow.
So, and then I moved that to a PhD at the Garvan. And that's where the greatest shift was. So I suddenly was in this PhD. I was at a fantastic institute. I was learning great science.
Yep.
Right? But I spent all day doing this.
Yep.
And I'm hyperactive, right? So, you know, you just – I couldn't do it. Enough, you know? Yeah. I did it, but I just couldn't do it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I dug in. You know, it wasn't a fun period of time. You know, but a PhD is never fun just for those – who are, you know, PhD's a nightmare, you know, or else you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not learning, you know, taking a good look at yourself during a PhD, it's all wrong for you. So, but during that time, I understood then that where I wanted to be was more at the pointy end of how do we get science to humans? Because all my background was in humans, right?
Well, how did a penny drop, should I ask?
So, I guess it was a natural enthusiasm towards humans and to just be at the cell level was suddenly, you know, this is almost
divorced from that. Yeah.
Yeah. This is almost philosophical now. And how do we get that link? And I want to be back where humans are. Right.
Yeah.
So during my PhD, I went through this period to understand where that was. And what happens in companies, at all the translation around the world happens in companies.
Yes.
So I went and said, well, I've got to learn companies. So I did a postgraduate finance degree at the same time.
Fair enough.
As you do, you know, which was, I don't recommend that to anybody, by the way. It was a tough period, but once again, you know, it's not about
way of thinking.
If we drift it back to the lessons before, it's not about winning every day, right? It's about trying to figure out along the way what's the right path. And I knew where I wanted to be. And it just took a bit more. And I was almost there, but I was just stuck in a hole at that time. Mm-hmm. And just dug in, got my PhD done, handed in my PhD, and then went for, you know, a couple of roles in investment banking, mm-hmm. went straight into investment banking. They liked my background. I had no experience, obviously, but they liked, you know, fundamentally my background mm-hmm. and took up a role there. And then I was headhunted, you know, within a couple of years with a group called Intech.
Yep.
And I spent the rest of my investment banking years there. At a great boutique organization. That's where I was an executive director and shareholder with three other guys, really. Mm. And
did they share the passion that you had for sort of biotech and for healthcare?
Well, you know, in a team, you don't necessarily want other people with exactly the same skills, right? That's so I was the only one with a PhD, but there was two lawyers and an accountant. So we had a cross of skills that then we're known as the main team in Australia in life sciences.
Wow, okay.
So I ended up getting this incredible experience from doing US company, you know, IPOs in Australia and learned how the US did it, you know, because they're more well known for translation of science than we are. Mm. And then, but after many years of that, really in the coalface of investment banking, you know, you're in the office at 6:30 a.m. You're out of the office on a good night at 7:30 p.m.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had a couple of kids and it's just hard to do everything. It's not that I didn't love it. It's just that right now I'm due for a change.
Yeah.
And this is when I stepped out to shift out from there. And then obviously I told the Clarity story before. It was more about this. Really the move to focus more on Australian translation.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think that's a fantastic story, Alan. I mean, it's so interesting that it starts from a coach back in, you know, Paddock Colts, and you learn those lessons all the way. And I think this is part of this series that we want people to actually get to meet people like you, because I think if there's more people get to hear about people like you, the more they can get inspired and understand that there's lots of ways to commercialize and to build better futures, especially in healthcare. So I think I appreciate you sharing that. And it's an amazing eclectic sort of journey that you've been on. I wanted to pivot back to your role at Clarity or Clarity per se, because you talk a lot about how important IP was. And that was sort of the starting point where you had, there was some IP and some good founders, some good science. I want to sort of delve into that a little bit. MedTech and healthcare is not like, you know, apps or, you know, digital world where maybe IP is not so important and first mover, you know, getting more users is more important. So I want to just talk a little bit about IP, since you've got a lot of exposure, a lot of experience there. So you can talk to maybe the viewers and the listeners about IP. And can you just tell us a little bit what role it plays in MedTech and in life sciences and what you would sort of, what do you think is most important in regards to IP and commercializing MedTech?
Yeah, good question, you know, and it's quite funny. And to use an analogy, right? So just say we're in property, because IP stands for intellectual property, right? Just say we're in property and we're in office blocks, okay? Mm. Not having IP in MedTech is like being in property and not owning any buildings.
Okay, that's a good analogy. That's a good
one. It's exactly the same thing, right? All of your property in a med tech or a life sciences company is intellectual property. It's patents and those sorts of things. Because what you're looking to do is position yourself with a freedom to operate first, so you're not impinging any previous or prior art, and you want to map out your area so then you can be the main player in that space. So then you can do things like raise capital, further build on the story, because you're basically building the building then, like literally, right? And part of that is, you know, the services you provide in the end. But you need that to be protected because of the amounts of capital you need to raise to do that.
And in all your time raising capital, has that been a focus in terms of companies having IP and having that secure with the freedom to operate?
Well, if you don't have it, you don't have anything. So it's an obvious thing for me, you know, to share with people, you need it in our space to develop, because other people will just utilize it. So you don't have any competitive advantage then, right? Mm. At Clarity now, you know, we started off with a couple of patents, provisional patents, and one sort of lot was good out of the University of Melbourne, but now we're at, you know, 14 patent families. Mm. We just filed another 4 patents here, you know, last week to make sure we can sort of garner our position. Now, we're the number one player in the world in copper theranostics, right, in the development of copper isotopes for both diagnosis and therapy. Right. And so that allowed us position then to negotiate deals on copper 67 supply, which are exclusively to us. Mm. So we're able to be that number one player in the space. Mm. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to do that, but we found a little bit of a road. We found a lot of things are starting to come in our direction in radiopharmaceuticals, but fundamentally built from the bottom up, where we've got a strong intellectual property position.
I think that's an interesting point as well, because in the work that we do, we often advising startups that I think sometimes startups think they have this one bit of IP and that's it. But what people don't really realize is that as you start developing your solutions, as you start going down that road, more opportunities come your way. You spend more time, you develop new IP and that portfolio grows. So you've grown it now to 14 patents. You start off with 2. I think people need to understand, and for those coming into BBFH and, you know, for those people looking to start up their own companies, it's important to have IP, but also to have a view to how to grow that IP, right? Because it's not just that one thing and that's it, and that's what your whole company's built on.
No, it's too, you know, I'll give you an example in real time. So there's different types of patents, right? Mm. There's composition of matter, which is really strong, right? This is specifically over the structure of your product. Mm. Then you've got things like manufacturing-based process patents, the like, and then even formulations and whatever. But, you know, for instance, we've got our core technology for some of our products and some other, and we build on that from process patents. But then we developed a new product, our PSMA patent for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. We looked at the science which was out there. We worked closely with Professor Paul Donnelly. We structured a different product so that we get more uptake into the tumor and it's actually there for longer. And these are the two things we want, right? We want lots in there and we want it there longer because we've got a radiation dose into that tumor. And then it clears through the kidney, safely through the kidney, is the overall philosophy of what we do. So we're able to rebuild it and then get a new patent position over that. So now we've got, you know, 18 years of patent life still left. Mm. And that means we've got a good run at commercializing that. If you don't have it, you can't raise the funds to commercialize. Mm. So if you don't have that strong position, it's just too difficult.
Yeah, that's a good question as well. I think, you know, in pharmaceuticals and maybe perhaps in theranostics where you are, the patent lifespans of 20 years isn't the norm. Is that enough for you to sort of get into the market and then commercialize and make a return? Or is there other strategies that you consider? Because it's a very unique space, right? There's a lot of science, a lot of clinical trialing. It takes a lot of time, and not a lot of investors have patience for that, to be honest as well. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to this question, right? Mm. You know, this IP usually sits in tech transfer offices within universities, right?
True.
And sits there with it's a depleting asset, right, over time. Mm-hmm. The 20 years, you don't have that asset anymore.
Yep.
So, and a lot of it is stuck in those situations and not coming out. So that's really difficult, because by the time it comes out, it probably doesn't have enough commercial life left, right? Yep. So that's one situation. The second part is, because if you ask specifically on the PSMA patent,
yep,
right, we were a bit different, right? We were already running in the space.
Right.
We filed the patent. We're running two clinical trials already, right? One in the US, a theranostic trial in the US. That's diagnostic and therapy in the US. We were already moving into therapy for that product, mm-hmm, right? And then we're running a diagnostics trial. You know, we just announced last week we're 50% recruited for that trial.
Yes, I noticed that.
We showed the images, yeah, you know, against a competing product. And we're well ahead there, right? So within 2 years, we've got that in the clinic running two clinical trials.
So it's a pace at which you go that's different, yeah?
Yeah. So it's a bit different when you've already got that, you know, it's inertia, right? Yeah. If it's stuck in there and you've got none,
exactly,
you've got no movement, then it's hard to get that going. If you're like us, we've got inertia moving, right? We're moving. So then we can just keep it rolling now.
Do you strategically time when you file, or do you still work in the background sort of under confidentiality and before you, or do you patent as soon as you've got something? How do you approach it?
You need a patent strategy.
Yeah.
There's some things that you want to file earlier, to get obviously that position. There's some that you may hold off for a little while. But from our perspective, because you know, when it's first put in, it's only a name.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's you know, it stays how it is until you receive the patent, and it's more public as to the position. Mm-hmm. So there's some confidential stuff we're working on now that we filed some stuff on, mm-hmm, but and you want that to run sort of under the radar until you're ready to show it to the world.
But I think that's also important that people need to understand is that when you're commercializing a company like a Clarity or like Anthematic, it's about having that continual development, having IP to follow from what you've got, because basically you're trying to build a company, not just a one product company, I should say. You try to build up a bit more of a portfolio to be a bit more investable. Would you say that's sort of a more sort of, not safe, but I guess more successful type of strategy where you're trying to build out value?
Do you know what? I want to take this back to something earlier in our conversation. I want to take it back to the Dick Wells example, right?
Yeah.
It's being meticulous across every part of your business, right? Or, you know, for us, we're a football team, which is the same, right? You're a motivator of players and you're trying to deliver strategy, and part of it is the theoretical, you know, the plans and whatever. The other part is implementation, you know, practice and those sorts of things, and being so well drilled. Using all of that now is IP is incredibly important. You want to get smart people on there who are dedicated, enthusiastic about that, and trying to get position. Because if you've got people in there who are just, you know, ticking boxes, it doesn't work, right? You don't want someone sort of coming in and just working through a process of patent finding. You want them to be enthusiastic and thinking about the game.
Yep. So like a strategy, like how are you going to execute this and what's the best way to get to there? Absolutely.
So we work with Davis Collison Cave.
Yes.
We've had a close association with them for years, and we've actually brought one of their people on one day a week, so they're constantly looking at our portfolio, someone who's worked in our portfolio for the last however many years. So they've got great insight, right, and they're enthusiastic, and now we're just – okay, position here. This is what we want to do.
Yeah.
And it's about being meticulous at those different levels.
And sharing those conversations, right? Not just compartmentalizing people into, oh, you're the IP, like, I'll give you something when it's ready. It's like getting them in because they see things differently, right? They see opportunity where you might not see. Yes. So I think that's something that
– and it's about discussing that, discussing what the opportunity is. How do you get that together, you know? This is what we want to do. Can we do this? Can we do this? Oh, I think you should do this. Okay, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Different skills.
That open mindset, you know, that almost that critique and challenging each other. I think that people sort of shy away from at times. I think it's so important. Different mindsets, different perspectives.
I think you have to have that in startup world, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? It's you don't have all the answers. You need to bring in different groups that have a different perspective on
and
things.
Challenge each other.
Because they have different experiences, you know?
Yeah.
And you hope some of those... You know, because some people shy away from conflict and stuff. I think conflict is beneficial in those meetings to say, step up, tell your mind, you know, tell us what you're really thinking here, and trying to extract that from the, you know, different types of people, I think is a skill in itself.
Yeah.
Because you want to hear from the quiet person.
Yeah.
Who might be the brightest person in the room, you know? Just because they're shy doesn't mean they're not intelligent. They probably are the most intelligent. So trying to extract those ideas in an open forum.
Force those crossovers, I think, yeah, is important.
Definitely.
So we talked about IP and I just want to segue from that into sort of capital raising, because that's where you've done a lot of work. And just an open question to those people who are listening and watching, advice on capital raising. I know it's a very open question, but put yourself in the shoes of, you know, a startup. What advice would you give them about capital raising? What comes to mind first that you'd share with them?
Yeah, it's interesting. And a lot of people ask this question of me, given my background, right?
So I'm just following the rest.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it shouldn't be about the deal.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be about the story, you know? And a lot of people—
Very good point.
A lot of people learn capital raising from a book.
Yep.
This is what a Series A looks like. This is what a Series B looks like. So am I doing a Series A or B? Well, you know, I can't even tell you what a Series A, B, C, D is.
I had that same question the other day, so I didn't know what it was.
You know my answer?
Yeah.
I've got the last capital raise, I've got the current one, and what's the next one going to look like?
Yeah.
That's what I've got, right? And it sort of developed from the US venture capital area, these size, because the venture capital want to say, I'm going to give you a prescriptive thing, I'm going to give you $5 million, Series A. It's going to be a pref share. It's going to have all these positions, and I'm going to literally try and take everything. You know, that's really what it is, right? Whereas I'll give you the living example of Clarity. When I came on board, there was ordinary shares on issue, right? Right, we have to do this next capital raise, right? It was done at a very low capitalization. It was $2.5 million or something at the time. And I said, well, let's raise this amount, 2.5 plus 1. Right? We raised one that got us over the next couple of years, but the one was sold on the story. This is what we're going to do. This is who we are today. We have these assets. There may not be much, but that's why the pricing is here and not here. So let's get that pricing right so we can all share in what is that upside together.
Yep.
And we bring the investors in not as the enemy,
but as a partner, right?
As a partner in the story.
And you have to find the right partners, right? With the right mindsets that align with your value. Yep.
It doesn't always work, right? It doesn't always work, but Absolutely. You want people who are going to help you in that next phase, So we did that. We brought on, you know, as a pharmaceutical company, you know, that we knew very well. They came on for part of it and a couple of other life sciences investors that were part of my network.
Mm-hmm.
So we closed that first million out in a very short amount of time. Then that lasted us a couple of years. Then we went out to raise another million, but we were oversubscribed. We raised two. That's when we brought Chris Roberts onto the board.
Sure, yeah.
Chris Roberts of Cochlear fame.
And before that, ResMed,
ResMed and Cochlear. Yep. So, and he was CEO of Cochlear for, 12 years or something?
Yeah, for a while,
Don't quote me on that, but it's, you know, many. And he's a bright guy, and he was enthusiastic about the story. Came on board, and then we started to build upon that. We started to get clinical trial results. We got grants. It was the Malcolm Turnbull phase, discussing commercialization. Innovation.
Yeah.
Great. So we got some grants. The government were supportive. Small grants, but they were supportive during that time. But we were able to raise more capital. And so the capital then came from, well, we've got this. This is our data. This is what we're going to do. We've got grant funded for this amount. You're coming in with the Australian government, but the Australian government is actually non-dilutive funding. You come in, you get a position in the company, we grow this to the next level.
I've been lucky enough to be mentoring some startups as well. And it's funny because every time they pitch to you, they talk about all the size of the markets and what the returns are going to be. And I keep on saying, well, okay, that's not so as important as tell me the story. You know, you're not going to be in a position to commercialize if there wasn't a big market or there wasn't some value upside. But what's the story and how do you build that? I think that's so important. It seems to be something that we sort of share in terms of that perspective.
Yeah. And it comes back to, you know, that it was sort of a joke, but there's some truth in it. The cult leader thing, right?
Yeah.
You should be bringing along your shareholders as an important part of that story. So then when you do your next capital raise, they don't have to be educated. They're already educated. You update them all the time on the news and the news flow and things and your achievements. That when you do your next capital raising, they should be cornerstoning it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they come in and cornerstone. You've got, you know, maybe anywhere from 20 to 50% of the next deal done.
Builds confidence for the rest.
It builds the confidence for the rest of the people coming on board.
Fantastic. That's a really good advice. I think when you talk about it from that perspective, it's usually these things garnered from your experience that people, you know, these nuggets of information, I think that people appreciate. So this brings us back to our little dropping the ocean of BBFH. I just want to talk a little bit about that because you've been with us for 6 years and we're so privileged and glad that you've been with us for 6 years. I think we just met each other just before then. I think that's when we realized, hang on, is your brother so-and-so? Your brother actually went to school with myself and George, which is quite funny. And then we got to know each other and then he started on the very first BBFH. In regards to BBFH and everything that we've spoken about, what do you think the benefits to those who are joining or going through this small little program are in terms of their journey to commercialization?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it's quite funny. So it was actually, there was us meeting and then George and I bumped into each other all around the world.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I was a part
drinking,
of those sessions. Yeah.
Drinking whiskeys at all sorts of,
That's right.
Whiskey yes. bars.
I just heard the story. Never got to partake.
And it's there where you get to learn about people, right? Yeah, we got to know more of each other and what we believe in and how we work. And I think that there isn't many of us, right? Mm-hmm. There isn't many of these people who are, dedicated to this. Now we called investment banking the dark side, but the translation of science is viewed the dark side too. I don't know why. I have no idea why trying to get this science to humans is dark. Yeah, I don't get any concept of that. Yeah. But it's viewed as that from a scientific perspective.
Probably, right? Tough.
Yeah. But when there's people around you that have done it before, and have that knowledge and know-how. Mm-hmm. Then working with them, because the first time you do it it's going to be difficult. Mm. I don't know, bring it back again. You want to be meticulous. Mm. You want to make sure you have this knowledge, this thirst for learning, and you want to be around the right people to do that. Once again, I bring it back to Dick Wells. I learned so much from him, right? Not just what he taught me, but how to learn and how to teach and those sorts of things. Yeah. When we're here now, right, it's trying to find the right people to hang out with because they've got knowledge or contacts or know-how. They can open a door in a second instead of, you going in cold or those.
For a year trying to find the right door, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know guys who do that. I know this person over here. And it just makes the process a lot easier. They've done it 50 times already, For instance, the IPO process, it was interesting. I've done probably 10 IPOs previously on the investment banking side, but I already have my team. I spoke to, our lawyer, David Morris. David, we're going to do this. Okay, I'm in.
I'm in, yeah.
Okay. I spoke to, brought in our investigating accountant. I've done already 5 deals with him, So having those contacts is really important. When you're going in cold, if you're a founder, you might be a scientist or an engineer. You don't have any of those networks. You don't have any of those capabilities, right? What do you know about IP? Well, I have a single patent. Well, what else is there here?
Yeah. What else can we do? Asking the right questions. Yeah. Right? I sort of talk about it is in we have the scars and the bruises from the previous battles. You don't have to go through it necessarily, try to maximize your chances. There's no guarantees in anything that we do. That's something that I'm always very clear about. But working and BBFH is part of it, trying to share the knowledge and trying to help people with all these years of experience through the contacts, through asking the right questions, more so than anything else, right? It's not always telling them the right answers, but asking the right questions because a lot of the answers are within them. And then also, but helping them execute as well as what we try to bring. Just going over the past 6 years, Alan, anything that stands out, any moments that stand out for you besides any, events, drinking sessions or anything?
Look, I think all up, having the community come together at the one place, and it was great, when we're doing those live events. Because I'm a fan of the live events, obviously. And but you're bringing the whole community together, driven by yourself and George fundamentally, right? Bringing this together in during Vivid or something like that, where it's a real event, people are there seeing translation straight. They're in front of them. The opportunity to see those and then share and critique and ask questions. Yeah. It's all fun as part of a process. And then get together afterwards, have a few drinks, whatever. We're talking a lot about drinking.
But there are connections that happen there that are still there today, right?
A few get together and understanding, how this works from people who are there at the coalface. Yeah. People who are doing it themselves, and if you've got the opportunity to, learn and listen or take it, and not even, I don't mentor, I don't do that. So I share information freely.
Absolutely.
It's hard what we do, and it's harder if you don't have any of that sort of contacts or experience. Yeah. So to start opening, especially for good opportunities, I think your events and you know, and that's why I've loved being part of it every year.
Yeah,
it's not just for the great beer. It's actually, you know, for the environment that we're trying to promote here, which is translation of good Australian science.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know about you, Alan, but I get inspired just listening to some of the people and some of the stuff that they're trying to do. You know, it's one of those invigorating moments. I mean, we're lucky enough to see a lot of that, but having those people with their passion and their eyes bright and they want to achieve something, they've done some great science or they've got a great idea or they've done something remarkable, it is invigorating, not just for us who are running the event, but at those live events, and hopefully we get back to it next year. But they see that and there's always a great vibe around it because people start to get passionate, they make connections that are still there today, they're sharing information. So that's all really what keeps us going with BBFH as well, like, because we're here about sharing the knowledge to try to help build the industry for everyone, right? It's a win-win partnerships. Is really what it's all about.
We all know, starting from the beginning, your company has no name, no recognition, has no employees, you have no role. It's just, you know, it's kicking
everything,
off.
Do everything.
It's do everything, right? Yeah. It's kicking off. You're going to get kicked to the curb so many times. So to have these opportunities where you're in a safe environment, right? And you can learn and listen and take all that in. That's rare for startups. Doesn't matter what business you're starting.
Yeah.
When you start out, it's incredibly hard. In our area, it's a little harder because we don't even know if we've got a product at the end of the day, whether we can sell, right?
That's true.
That's how hard it is.
That's true. That's
so,
it's a long journey, right?
It's a long journey.
So 6 months and I've got users, you know?
You don't get immediate feedback where someone buys your product.
Correct.
You're planning for the future that in 10 years, someone's going to buy your product.
And they're going to let you sell it. That's the other thing, right?
Exactly.
Gatekeepers along the way.
Exactly.
It's been great chatting so far, Alan. I think we probably got to wrap it up now. But before you go, I should say, 2021, 2020 has been a pretty difficult year. I'll use that as a nice way to explain it, or years, I should say, with a pandemic. How do you think the pandemic has changed medtech, life sciences, and what are you hoping for in the coming years now that we're sort of, well, hopefully, in a new phase of it, or at least, or it's behind us, hopefully? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm probably the eternal optimist. So, and you have to be, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I've found the last couple of years to be, you know, quite insightful, you know, and I come back to that thing, you know, life isn't great every day for everybody, right? And so when you're digging deep during those periods, I got to tell you, when we kicked off, we went first into that lockdown.
Yep.
You may recall, I was kicking off a capital raise.
Yes, I do remember.
For $25 million. Dollars. For a company that's in cancer, it's not even in infectious diseases. And, you know, it was April, I think, and I'm ringing around. I'm sitting in my backyard ringing people saying, oh, we've opened up this capital raising. I don't even know what's going to happen, Alan, you know, let alone this. Well, we closed off that $25 million, right? At the back end of the year, we brought in some new investors and, you know, it ended up being a good outcome. But it was a deep dive.
Yes.
Right. And understanding, right, where are we? What are we going to do? And not, you know, let's, you know, we don't give up here, right? We just kick on, play the straight bat. We've got a great straight opportunity bat, yeah. here, and we've got a great company and great products. We continue on, and we did that. And obviously, this year has been a benefit. Mm. Now, COVID was fascinating this year. I did the whole IPO, a global roadshow.
Yep.
From virtually. Our office. Yeah. So I had no jet lag except for 6 a.m. starts and 11 p.m. finishes, but there was no travel and those sorts of things. But I think this whole experience has been, we're seeing science in real time, right?
Yep.
So the scientist part of me goes, it is miraculous what we achieved.
Right? For sure.
We've got these technologies, which are actually 40 years ago, but they started work on the mRNA vaccines.
That's what people don't realize, right?
40 years ago, right? Yep. And suddenly we have safe and effective vaccines broadly to market in a short amount of time because they're easier to manufacture and they went through clinical trials. It was a monumental thing. So for me, it's gone, wow, that is translation in real time.
At warp speed.
and it just happened because we have the knowledge, we have the technology, we're incredible science and the like, and we're able to capitalize that. People, I'm going to tell you, because everyone hates pharmaceutical companies and whatever, the pharmaceutical companies were investing in infrastructure, starting to build these vaccine facilities when the vaccines were still in phase two. There might have been no likelihood that you would use that. That is just, you know, that's a lot of balance sheet to put up those periods of time. It was incredible. And so to see that happen by humans around the world and scientists being front page and those sorts of things, I think was a wonderful period. But it's brought out a you know, an area of the public which, you know, I find sort of
I don't know, you know, the you know, not to get political, but the Craig Kellys of the world locally, you know, people are getting healthcare advice off Craig Kelly. It's like, are you serious? It's a crazy world in that sort of situation. But I think in Australia, it's a small and rowdy lot. And I think that this adoption of science and the like and seeing science, I think will inspire a whole bunch of young scientists to, you know, to head into the realm of science.
And bring it to the people, right?
So I think it's, you know, and certainly, you know, my own kids now know, you know, what the vaccines are, how they evolve. You know, this is mRNA vaccines, this is the next step. This is the science behind it. Let's read exactly what the science is. And I think that's been, you know, in real time for a lot of people, suddenly people know what PCR is. I've been using PCR for years. I hated, you know.
All these acronyms.
RT-PCR. I was in the lab, you know, 20 years ago using RT-PCR. And one at a time, you know. Now they've got, you know, automation facilities and automation. I was doing one RT-PCR at a time on a particular.
You've been obsoleted.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why science can move so much faster now, right?
Yeah.
Single scientist to an RT-PCR. Yeah. You've got machines who are doing it. So, look, I'm incredibly sort of excited about how we've overcome such a, you know, such a large pandemic in what is a reasonable amount of time. Omicron, we'll see, you know, the new variant. We'll see how it evolves.
Yeah.
We haven't got enough data yet, right? We'll see how that data evolves.
With it, right?
But let me tell you, I feel really, really, really good that science has been able to treat it.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think it has put science front and center, and hopefully that has inspired maybe some future people that we will come across in our work in the next 10, 15 years. Who knows?
Exactly.
Thank you so much for today. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope the viewers and the listeners do as well. Thank you, and I hope you keep on kicking goals with clarity, and we'll see you in the judging.
Perfect.
Thanks,
Richard. Thanks so much.
Thank you.